Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome back to another episode of Fired Up. This is your man, Steve, and here we are. This broadcast is happening 2 days before Christmas, so let me start it off by saying Merry Christmas, everybody. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. Let's enjoy the season. Let's make sure we stay safe and enjoy it with our family and friends. In the spirit of the season, want to take a little bit different tack with the show this week. Want to kind of talk a little bit about how the holiday spirit can really help motivate and empower us to move forward with our agenda of being awake and woke and being active and getting engaged and educated. I'm going to use, when we talk about the holidays, of course, all three of the major holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, are all centered around, spirits of family, of cooperation, of moving forward, of being thankful for our blessings and things that we have around us, and also empowerment and moving forward with the goals that we set and the things that we need to do. Going to use, just for sake of the discussion, we're going to use the principles of Kwanzaa simply because they are, very much focused on the spirits of unity and family and community and sharing and so forth. Although, not to take anything away from, Christmas, which is, of course, about the spirit of giving and, belief in the faith and all of that. And Hanukkah, which is a holiday celebrating freedom from oppression. It's celebrating spirituality and engaging with your religion and the principles and moving forward with that. But we're going to use the principles of Kwanzaa to kind of illustrate the points I want to talk about today. Kwanzaa is an African-American holiday, and there are seven basic principles to it. So I'm going to go through each one, name it, define it, and then kind of give how I think we can use the principles of Kwanzaa in our efforts to achieve a more balanced country, to move away from the divided partisan country that we have and get more toward a country that represents who we really are as American people. So the first one is called Umoja, and it stands for unity. And the definition is, it says, success starts with unity of family, community, nation, and that really ties into the overall message that we've been carrying forward with our Fired Up show here, in that we need to be unified as a people. We need to, be engaged with our community, with our elected officials, with our local, state, and federal government. We need to be engaged and communicating with them to let them know, what it is that they need to be doing since they work for us. And we need to bring that spirit of community, that spirit of, one nation, as we say, and, use that as a motivating force as we move forward. The second principle of Kwanzaa is Kujichagulia, and that is self-determination. And this one is about being responsible to ourselves and to create our own destiny, very much in line with, the goals and objectives we need to set in order to make sure that we begin the process of moving forward to get our country to where we want it to be, to see the change that we want to happen. The third principle is called Ujima, and it's collective work and responsibility. And again, it is all about building teams and building groups and working toward a common goal with our friends and our peers, and making sure that we do the things we need to do. The definition says to build and maintain your community together, to work together to help one another within your community. Very much a principle we need to apply continuously, not just in holiday season, but going forward. The next one is Ujamaa, and that is collective economics. Obviously, if we are going to build a more inclusive culture in our country, we are going to need to practice collective economics to build, maintain, and support our own businesses, establishments, stores, etc. you know, it's all about empowerment. It's all about bringing together the best in our community and expanding that outward to include, you know, beyond our community borders to our state borders and to our national borders. The next principle is called NIA, and NIA is purpose. To restore people to their traditional greatness, to be responsible to those who came before, that is our ancestors, and to those who will follow, our descendants. And nothing could be more true when we talk about bringing the lessons we learned from our history forward, teaching our children and having them pass that message along down the line to their children, creating that process of communication of where we have come from and where we are going to the future generations that come. The next principle is Kuumba, and it's creativity. And you know, we use creativity and imagination to make our communities better, to improve them beyond the communities that we inherited, so that we hand off a better community, a better local area, state, federal, and country to the generations that come after us. And the last principle is called Imani, and that is faith. And faith is critical and key to whatever we need and want to accomplish. Believing in our people, our families, our educators, our leaders, and the righteousness of the struggle of the people. You know, believing in that, having faith in that, you know, having the spirituality and the moral background and the moral structure that guides us to what is best for our country. So, you know, that's one set of how the principles of Kwanzaa can, you know, help us and give us guidance and direction in what we do. And again, and not to, you know, to pick one over the other, I chose Kwanzaa because of the seven principles, because they speak to such a broad collection of, you know, responsibility and community activism and the kinds of things that we've been talking about over the weeks here on Fire It Up, and the kinds of things that I believe are what we need to do in order to change the direction our country is going to into one that reflects all of the people, not just those, you know, the elite or, you know, the ones on one side in one party and the other side in another party. You know, and these principles are carried out both in the Christmas holiday with its strong center of faith and belief and goodness and giving to others, as well as the principles of Hanukkah with its strong belief in, you know, liberation from oppression and, you know, moving forward with our community and our people, our culture, and our faith. So if we take these principles and apply them, you know, in our, you know, our daily lives, in our work lives, in our political lives, you know, we can make really strong progress toward the more representative country of the people in it than what we have right now. So, you know, those are just, you know, some opening thoughts, you know, as we, again, as of the airing of this show, we are roughly about 36 hours away from Christmas Day. You know, and obviously that is a very joyous holiday here in America. We celebrate it, you know, with a lot of gusto and a lot of anticipation, you know, but we need to make sure that we keep in our hearts and in our minds the spirit of the holidays, which is about being beyond ourselves, giving to one another, being aware of those that are less fortunate than us, and reaching out and helping those that need help. So those are the principles and kind of the guide that we should be following in our everyday lives, but they're emphasized when we come into the holiday season here as we are right now. So that being said, we'll switch gears a little bit and kind of talk about current events and what's going on in the world. And of course, that means we've got to talk about the current events that we saw happen this past week. Of course, the impeachment process has moved through the House of Representatives. And let me just give you an update as to the results of that. As we talked about earlier, the House of Representatives passed two articles of impeachment toward the president, and those were brought out of committee and voted on by the full House. And the end result is on the first article, the yeas were 229, the nays were 197. It was one vote of present and three no votes registered. And in Article 2, there were 229 yeas, 198 nays, one voting present, and three voting no vote. So that means that two articles of impeachment were delivered and will be taken over to the Senate for the next phase in the impeachment process, which is actually the trial in the Senate of the articles of impeachment against the current president. Some things to note about this vote. Obviously, this vote occurred right down party lines. The Democrats control the House of Representatives, and they almost all voted in favor of the articles of impeachment, and the Republicans almost all voted against it. Although, one thing to note and an interesting point is that one of the representatives voted present, which means it reflects that you are in the part of the quorum, part of the voting body, but you are not exercising a vote either way, and nor are you registering a no vote or an absent vote. So, you know, that kind of raised some eyebrows and may create a little bit of a political firestorm in the home district of that representative. As again, you know, I talk about the process. I don't necessarily talk about the people, but it's interesting to see that, you know, this individual, this representative, you know, is sort of central to the debate we're having. And, you know, she is Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, and she also happens to be one of the candidates for president on the Democratic side of the aisle. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out over the course of the Democratic debates and primaries that will be coming in a matter of months now. We should see the first primaries in around February, I believe. And we will see how this plays between now and then. The other thing to keep in mind is that we also had this week the latest Democratic debate. There were only seven candidates on the stage, with four major candidates or five major candidates who did not make the criteria for the Democratic debate platforms. And we want to talk a little bit about that as well. So just to kind of give you background, the Democratic National Committee, like the Republican National Committee did in 2016, they set standards for who could participate in these, you know, televised debates among the candidates. And if you've been paying attention to that, you've seen the field go from, I think the first one had, I want to say 16, and it's now whittled down through the Democratic process here down to seven people that made the cut for the last debate. And that cut was at least 200,000 unique donors. That is, 200,000 individuals had to have given you a sum of money, a campaign donation, and you had to score 4% or more in several national level polls prior to the debate in order to qualify to participate. And there's some controversy around this in this go around, because these thresholds eliminated almost all of the minority candidates for president, with the exception of Andrew Yang. And what we ended up with was, you know, a stage of six whites and one Asian that, you know, many critics say does not, you know, equitably represent the demographics of the United States of America. And that raises a question. And the question out there is this type of process, whether it's Democratic or Republican, because they had much the same strategy in their debates in the 2016 election cycle. Number one, is this a fair process? Is setting a number of unique donors and a polling threshold a proper way to allow candidates to participate in debates that are designed to get their message and their platform out before the public in order to, you know, convince voters that they are the viable candidate to represent the Democratic Party, in this case, in the upcoming election in November? Is that the only way that we can, establish the baseline by which we allow our candidates the opportunity to speak to us directly through the medium of television and internet and all the other forms of communication? Or are there other ways? I gave this a little bit of thought, and I was wondering, throwing out there as a possible idea is perhaps it would be better if the respective national committees, the Democratic Committee and the Republican Committee, if they set up some type of a donor system where, you call in or you log onto the website and you pick the candidate that you want to see in the debate and, set some minimum, a donation amount. Maybe it's $5. What you would end up with then is you would get a representative, hopefully, sample of the American voting public. They would indicate, their support for one candidate over another, or, maybe one or more candidates over another, put some skin into that through the donation of a small amount of money, say, $5. And, that would end up perhaps being a more representative way of getting candidates to the stage for the televised and broadcast debates. At the end of the day, the committees could use that money as part of, an advertising campaign for the party, not specifically for one candidate over the other, but it could help offset some of the costs for, Democratic advertising or Republican advertising or independent advertising or whatever. As I was thinking and looking at and listening to the arguments both for and against what is going on with the debate process, it just occurred to me that there's got to be a better way to do it that, helps the candidates, especially those who have good ideas, but just, for whatever reasons, and we can talk more about that as we get closer to the voting season, as to the kinds of things, and, we move into more discussions on the game of politics. There are some thoughts I have on that, and we'll come to that in future episodes of the show. But there are, maybe better ways in which to get the candidates, a broader perspective of all of the candidates that are out there, and have them get their ideas into the public discussion. Because ultimately, the ideas of these candidates, even though, whoever the supposed front runner is at the time, may or may not be on board with all of those elements, they are still important elements to those of us that support those political candidates from whatever party, and they deserve to have the light of day shined upon them so that they too can be considered as part of the electoral process and part of the platform process for the party as they go forward, in the competition of elections. So we will talk about this, more than once over the coming months, but I just wanted to put that out there. And, kind of flesh out that there may be other ways in which we can do this. So, that being said, we're going to go ahead and take our first break here. As I said, we're doing the show a little bit different this week in that because we are, you know, again, on the day this is broadcast, we are actually a day and a half ahead of Christmas. I'm going to insert some Christmas music into our breaks. Instead of, you know, usually I find tunes that are more politically motivated or speak to an issue, but this is Christmas, so we're going to do some really nice Christmas tunes. So we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fire It Up. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Hanukkah, and we'll see you right after the break.
It's Christmas time. There's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let in light and we banish shame.
And we're back. Just a note on that song, that's actually an oldie, but I picked it because I think the message is very relevant to current events going on, and it speaks to how we need to look beyond ourselves to our community, our state, our country, and the world, and see where, you know, we can take action to make a difference. So I picked that song as the first musical break in the show. Getting back into our subject, you're listening to Fire It Up. This is Steve, And we're going to move into something that falls in line with the subject we've talked about before, and that is, you know, actions being taken by others to restrict or suppress or diminish the vote. And in this case, it was a news item that came to my attention from one of the sources that I listened to. And it basically talked about in North Carolina that there was an arrest made, and there was some uproar where former felons, people who, you know, committed a crime but have served their time, have completed their sentence, and, you know, by law they should be able to return to become a registered voter, but they were being denied that and still disenfranchised, even though they have completed paying their debt to society. You know, and it talks about the article and the research I did pointed out that, you know, restoration of voting rights for former felons is basically a state level decision. In many cases, former felons who have completed their obligation to the criminal justice system, in order for them to regain their right to vote, they either have to petition, you know, a local official, you know, whether it is a, you know, local magistrate, or they have to petition, you know, to the governor of the state. And this has brought up some serious discussion and some widespread discussion about what, you know, this is about, and, you know, whether, you know, people who have paid their debt have earned the right to return, you know, to their status as a citizen, particularly where it comes to being able to vote. Over the last few decades, there's been a general trend toward reinstating the right to vote at some point, although, you know, as I said, it's a state-by-state policy choice. You know, and there is a wide variety of, you know, levels of this restriction called disenfranchisement, and it varies very, very widely. In almost all cases, automatic restoration does not mean that, you know, voter re-registration is automatic. Typically, you know, prison officials inform the election officials that an individual's rights have been restored. The person then has to be responsible for re-registering through normal process. Some states require that voter registration be provided to formerly incarcerated people, and California is one example of that. Some notes that I found, for example, in the state of Maine and the state of Vermont, felons never lose their right to vote even while they are incarcerated. 16 states, including the District of Columbia, felons lose their voting rights only while incarcerated and receive automatic restoration upon release. In 21 states, felons lose their voting rights during incarceration and for some period of time after, typically while they're on, you know, probation or parole. Voting rights are automatically restored once, you know, probation and parole requirements are satisfied. You know, and former felons may also have to pay outstanding fines, fees, or restitution before their rights are restored as well. And there was a case in the news, it came up, I believe it was late last year, where the state of Florida, in one move, you know, reinstated former felons the right to vote, but then, you know, legislature then put in a rule saying they have to pay out any restoration or whatever other fines and penalties were levied before their right to vote would be restored. In 11 states, felons lose their voting rights indefinitely for some crimes, or they require a governor's pardon in order for voter rights to be restored. They face an additional waiting period after completion of sentence, including parole and probation, or require additional action before voting rights can be restored. These states are listed, and I will post the list on my Facebook page as to which states have these kind of restrictions based on status, and also the numbers and percentages of the states. But you know, in a broad sense, it should be noted that 6.1 million people in the United States, 2.5% of the voting age population in as counted in 2016, could not vote due to a felony conviction. And this number actually was an increase over the prior year of over 4%. In addition to that, African Americans had 7.44% representation of the population that could not vote due to a felony conviction. And again, this was 2016 data. And notably, in Kentucky, 26.2% of African Americans were disenfranchised. And that's the highest percentage in all of the U.S. states. Florida had the highest numerical total of 1.7 million people and per capita of 10.43% disenfranchised population of all U.S. states. As I said, I will post the article on my Facebook page, and you can read it for yourself and draw your own conclusions. But again, to give you the national perspective, in the totals for all the states for the United States as a whole, a total of 1.33 million prisoners, 504,000 plus parolees, 1.12 prisoners with felony probation, and just a little bit under 64,000 felons in jail were disenfranchised, and 3.1 million post-sentence parolees were also not allowed to vote or disenfranchised. So that's a total, as I said earlier, of 6.1 million people nationwide out of a voting age population, and again, these are 2016 numbers, of 247,220,000 people. So about 2.4 or 2.5% of the U.S. population, because of a felony conviction and completion of sentence in one of the stages I just mentioned, still do not have their basic citizenship right of voting restored to them for one reason or another. And again, this is a state-level process. The states are in control of it. And, you know, if this is something that's important to you, this can be added to your action item list as something to talk to your state-level elected officials about. Find out what the policy is, what the barriers are, what can be done to correct it. Again, if you're in favor of restoring the right to vote to, felons that have completed their, their sentence and their, have done their time, have completed their debt to society, they should, by rights, as under the Constitution, they should be allowed to have access to all of the full citizenship rights. And again, there may be some, case-by-case restrictions. There may be some types of crimes that, create additional hurdles or additional exclusions. But in broad general terms, once a person has, completed their debt to society, the question then becomes, are they in fact now restored to a full citizenship status? And the fact that African Americans make up a significant portion of that 2.4% total is another point to discuss with your elected officials. So just some interesting information, and as we talk about, the games that are played upon us, this is one more to put in, to put on the game board that can be and is being used, to suppress and disenfranchise the vote. And just to add, some numbers to it, because I'm a numbers guy. The second article, again, this will be posted as well to my Facebook page so that you can read it your own. And in 1960, 1.76 million voters disenfranchised due to a felony conviction were listed. By 1976, that number had dropped down to 1.17 million. And then over the course of years to 2000, it more than doubled to 3.34 million. And then continued to rise year over year to 4.68 million people, and then 5.35 in 2000, 5.85 in 2008, and then the 6.11 million people in 2016. So, these numbers continue to increase, and it speaks to just another piece of the methodologies that are used against poor and minority people in this country, because not all of these people are minority. Some of them are poor and white as well, but they're all being disenfranchised, being stripped of their right to vote even after they have completed their payment of their debt to society. To take a half step back and really kind of flesh out just what this term disenfranchisement is. Disenfranchisement is the revocation of the right to vote of a person or group of people, or through practices, prevention of a person exercising the right to vote. Disenfranchisement is also termed to be the revocation of power or control of a particular individual, community, or being the natural amenity that they are abound in, and that is to deprive of a franchise, a legal right, of some privilege or inherent immunity. Disenfranchisement may be accomplished explicitly by law, or implicitly through requirements applied in a discriminatory fashion, intimidation, or by placing unreasonable requirements on voters for registration or voting. So basically that boils down to, they take your right to vote, or they take one of your allowed and conferred rights under the Constitution, under the laws of the United States, and they take that away because of the circumstance of your conviction and incarceration for a felony crime. Now, it doesn't just mean voting that can be taken away. There are other restrictions that can be placed. Restrictions on where you can live. And restrictions on jobs that you can hold. Restrictions on activities that you can participate in. For example, to give you a few examples, if you are a convicted sex offender and you have completed your sentence, there are still some disenfranchisements that apply, because you are required to register as an SSRO. You are required, to restrict your movements in certain areas of the community, and so on and so forth. Also, we look at gun ownership. Guns, by law, a felon cannot possess a firearm, and that's a long-standing law, and it actually is one that even, the pro-gun rights lobby agrees is one that is good to have, and we should do everything we can to enforce. Not all disenfranchisements are, totally draconian and negative. Some of them are put in place as, additional protections for the general public, given the specific circumstances of the crime that the individual has committed. When a lawyer is convicted of a crime, they are disbarred. They are prevented from practicing law anymore. When a financial individual or individual that works in the finance industry is convicted, they are banned from working in, the financial industry, you know, going forward. So there are some disenfranchisements that actually are, you know, for lack of a better word, justified given the nature of the crime that occurs. However, we need to, as always, you know, get educated, get informed, dig deeper, dig wider, and make sure that these disenfranchisement rules aren't being unfairly or, you know, disproportionately applied to one group or over another, whether it be minorities, whether it be poor people, whether it be, you know, legal status immigrants in the country. You know, for whatever of these reasons, you know, we need to make sure that, you know, the application of disenfranchisement rules is, you know, fair, equitable, and appropriate. So, you know, again, in our action items, as we talk about, you know, communicate, learn, educate, you know, discuss, and find out where your elected officials, both locally in the state and at the national level, where do they stand on these matters? You know, make this known that this is important to you. All right. So we'll follow up with this. We'll gather more information and we'll revisit it, you know, in a future episode, because I think it is part of an overall toolkit of voter suppression that is being applied as part of a political strategy. And we've talked about this over many weeks now, that it is intended to reduce the voting population on one side of the column to give the other side of the column a better chance of getting into power or maintaining power. You know, you can line this up in a row with, you know, the Southern strategy that we've talked about in the past, with gerrymandering, with, you know, all of the voter suppression tactics that have been used, relocating voting places and to make it more difficult, the implementation of tests and taxes and fees and other impediments to keep people from voting, purging people from voting rolls in wide swaths of the community. You know, all of these things are all pages in the book of voter suppression that is being applied. And it's something that we need to be aware of, that we need to take action about, and that we need to make sure we are letting our elected officials know that we are watching and they need to pay attention to what we want. All right. So, you know, we'll take our second break here. Again, you know, it's Christmas time, and, you know, want to hopefully lighten the mood and, you know, celebrate the season. So we'll be back with our call to action segment right after this musical break. You're listening to Fire It Up. I'm Steve. This is WJMS Radio. Happy holidays, and I'm glad you're here with us.
Shepherd boy, do you hear what I hear? Ringing through the night, shepherd boy, do you hear what I hear? A song. Mighty King, do you
And we're back with the Christmas edition of Fired Up. This is your man, Steve. And we've been talking about a wide variety of subjects this episode. We talked about the Democratic debate, and we've talked about yet another example of a voter suppression tactic that is being implemented out there. And we've also talked about the holidays and the spirit of giving. And, you know, whether you celebrate Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or any other holiday at this time of year, the overriding bit is that, you know, holidays are about giving. It is better to give than to receive. And we need to look, you know, beyond ourselves to our community, to our localities, our states, and our country, and in fact, the globe, and think about, you know, how we can make an impact. So, you know, our first call to action is just that. In the spirit of holiday giving, beyond just your family and the important ones in your life and, you know, those you love, what can you do? What action steps can and should you be taking to make an improvement where you are, whether it's in, you know, local action in your community, being involved with your school board, your town councils, your state legislatures, communicating with your federal elected officials? What steps can you take, you know, in the coming year? You know, we always look at setting New Year's resolutions, or if you're like me, you set goals for your year as you start a new year. You know, so what goals, what resolutions, what actions, and, you know, what things should you be doing going forward to help in your, you know, in your part, make things better? You know, take an action step about getting more involved with your local government. You know, if you don't agree with things that are being taught in the schools, then you need to get involved with your school committees. You need to get involved with your parent-teacher organizations and all of that. If, you know, city politics, if there are things that come out that you find out about, you know, you need to become engaged with that. Let your elected officials know that you're there, that you're watching, that you're listening, that you want them to answer your questions. These are all steps that we can take, you know, to, you know, to give back to our communities, to give back to our state, to give back to our country, and to, in our little way, help make the world a better place. You know, that's a noble goal and a worthy action item to put on your list as we wind down 2019 and enter into 2020. You know, as always, we want to make sure that we continue to stay educated, to stay informed, to, you know, seek the truth, to dig deeper, dig wider, and make sure that we are verifying information that we hear. We don't just accept our information from a single source, that we actually are getting opinions from a wide variety of sources, both, you know, ones that line up with your thinking and ones that, you know, oppose your thinking. There are always good ideas in every discussion on both sides. So we need to make sure that we take every opportunity we can to get those ideas and make sure that we are integrating them into our own personal battle strategies. You know, in addition, we need to make sure, you know, that we are aware of what's going on, you know, in terms of, you know, what's happening with the elections, what's happening, you know, with, you know, the national politics. Yes, impeachment is, you know, overarching all of the news these days, but there are other things that are going on. There's legislation being passed and bills signed into law that are going to affect, you know, communities across this country. You know, there's, you know, debates and legislation going on about, you know, the pipeline being built across Indian land. You know, all of these things, you know, may not seem like they impact you, but they are all part of a strategy. They are all part of an approach to drive, you know, what this country considers to be important based on the opinions of one side of one group over the rest of us, whether it's, you know, on the left or on the right. Both sides play the game. You know, it's never been more evident than it has been in the impeachment process that's been going on, And if you are watching that and listening to it and listening closely, you can hear the game being played. So we need to be engaged. We need to be smart. We need to, make sure that we are doing everything we can to make the best, wisest, most informed choices, decisions, and actions that we can. So, those are the overriding goals that we have. And as I said, with this being the holiday time, we need to, take that broader view. Realize that while it's important to take care of family, that is vitally important, critically important, it's a top priority. We also need to expend some energy and reach out and help those who may be less fortunate than us, who may be one opportunity short of making that transition that can change the rest of their lives. And we need to make sure that we are engaged with our communities. It's an outward looking process. Definitely we want to make sure that, home and family and, all of those things are taken care of, that we walk in our respective faiths, that we treat each other as we would like to be treated. But we need to make sure that, we are engaged in the broadest sense that we can. So, it's important. It's something that, since launching this show and even before launching this show has been a concern of mine and a goal of mine year over year. So, that being said, I really, really want to wish each and every one of you the most happy and joyous holiday season. I hope it is both safe and satisfying, and that all of the things that are important to you happen, and that everything works well and gets you ready to transition into 2020. It's going to be some big things coming with Fired Up in the coming year. Not the least of which, I'm going to be working on my studio here, improving some of the technology and improving some of the things that I have. We'll talk more about that as we do our final episode of the year next week. And I'll kind of give you my rundown on what you can expect to come from Fired Up in the coming year. We're going to close down our call to action segment for this episode. Again, being a day and a half out from Christmas, I wanted to end on probably one of my personally favorite Christmas songs of all time. So as a different outro from the usual one I have, the usual David Bowie that I play, I want to close us out on a very, very warm and comfortable musical note, and just conclude by saying to each and every one of you out there, from me and my family and my friends in the WJMS family, we wish you the very, very best of a happy, joyous, and prosperous new year. We will see you again next week. You've been listening to Fire It Up right here on WJMS Radio. My name is Steve. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, and we'll see you again next week.
It was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
In my mind, I want you to be free.
Temptations.